So after the Babylonian exile, they're all coming back to Jerusalem. And today we finish, like, it's like a trilogy, right? So today we finish the trilogy, right? And sort of what was going on at this time period and what lessons can we draw from it? And this story is encompassed. It's not just like one book in the Bible, as we've seen, right? So there's the two historical books, Ezra and Nehemiah, which tell the story of the Jews coming back to Jerusalem. There's also the two of the minor prophets we've seen, Haggai and Zechariah, that sort of write at the same time, and they're writing about this. And as we've seen it, what we saw the first week we talked about this was in the book of Ezra, they get back together and they're going to build this temple. And they're going to build the temple, and they're back in Israel, and this is great, and then they start building the temple, and then they stop building the temple, and it sort of takes a long time to get around to building the temple, and eventually they get it built, but it's small. And it's small, and it doesn't look as impressive as everybody thought. It was sort of sad, and the punchline was, look, do not despise the day of small things. That's what God says. He says, do not despise the day of small things. Yes, it's a small thing you're doing, but it will result in great things. God's glory will be manifested in the end. And that's an inspiring message. And then last week, we looked in the book of Nehemiah, and we realized, you know, you go forward in time, and they've got a temple, but the city of Jerusalem's in rubble, literally rubble. You can't even ride a horse through the city. It's in such rubble. The walls are gone. The gates are gone. And they're oppressed by enemies all around. And then Nehemiah comes in, and they start rebuilding the wall. And that would be enough for one story, right? We're going to rebuild a wall and recreate a city, but that's not enough because then the enemies of Jerusalem start pouring in and they start saying, we're going to kill you while you're trying to build the wall. And so they have to defend themselves. And then the people start being oppressed by the landlords, and so they got to deal with that. And then they start trying to assassinate Nehemiah. I mean, it's just sort of this long set of like one thing after another, after another, after another. Here you are trying to do this great thing. And in the end, we realize, this is sort of a hard thing, but Nehemiah just stays faithful throughout, and he just keeps working at it and working at it and working at it. And that again becomes an encouraging and inspiring message. Today, what we want to talk about is this guy Joshua. And Joshua was the first high priest when they're building the temple. He was the guy that was actually there during the building of the temple. And Joshua has an interesting thing. We don't have a book named after him. There's a book named Joshua, but not about this guy, right? We don't have a book, but he gets mentioned in the book of Zechariah in a couple. He's also mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah. I mean, he's obviously a historical figure here in those stories too. But Zechariah, the book of Zechariah, it's one of these fascinating little minor prophet books. The minor prophet books are always great, right? Minor because they're short, right? But this one has got this sort of thing that, like, you know, if you're sitting down to read through the whole Bible, you rarely read Zechariah and think, oh, that one was great, right? And the reason is because it starts off with this whole series of visions. It's just one vision after another vision after another vision, and it seems bewildering. Like, what in the world are these visions about? There's no explanations. They just sort of march from one vision to the next. So we're going to pick up with one of those visions, Zechariah. It's the second to last book in the Old Testament. Zechariah, chapter 3, verse 1. Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right side to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" Now Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes, and he stood before the angel. The angel said to those who were standing before him, "Take off his filthy clothes." Then he said to Joshua, "See, I have taken away your sin, and I will put rich garments on you." Then I said, "Put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him while the angel of the Lord stood by. The angel of the Lord gave this charge to Joshua. "This is what the Lord Almighty says. If you will walk in my ways and keep my requirements, then you will govern my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you a place among those standing here. Listen, O high priest Joshua, and your associates seated before you, who are men symbolic of things to come. I am going to bring my servant the branch. See the stone I have set in front of Joshua? There are seven eyes on that one stone, and I will engrave an inscription on it, says the Lord Almighty, and I will remove the sin of this land in a single day. In that day, each of you will invite his neighbor to sit under the vine and fig tree, declares the Lord Almighty." Now we hear that and we instantly start trying to figure out seven eyes on a stone, what in the world is that? That's just sort of a weird image, right? And you know, it's sort of this like, we've missed the point. Imagine you're sitting in Jerusalem. So Joshua's here, right? We've got this guy Joshua, he's a high priest. We have no temple, the city's in rubble, and Zechariah comes forth and has this vision. And what's the first thing you hear in this vision? Well, you're not sitting around wondering about the seven eyes on the stone. You're like, wow, Joshua is dressed in dirty, filthy robes at the outset, and Satan is standing there accusing him. And what happens? God thunders forth, says to Satan, "Get out of here. This is my place now." He says, "Get rid of the filthy robes on Joshua, and we're going to put clean robes on Joshua." And then Joshua, the high priest, now clothed in glory, is given these magnificent promises of, "Look, you're going to prosper, and things are going to be great." And if you were sitting in a oppressed little city in rubble with no temple, and you hear this vision of this guy, the high priest, who is going to be moving from filthy robes being accused by Satan into a position of glory where the Lord is standing beside him, you would be very encouraged. This is an encouraging message. And we miss it because we get obsessed with the details, but the details aren't the thing that really matters here. The point that matters here is, there's a story here that God is going to perform a miraculous work and take this filthy, disgusting, dirty city that's in rubble, and he's going to bring it into glory, and it's going to be amazing, and the Lord will be there. And you can imagine they hear this, and they're like, wow, there's some hope here. God is standing by the side of this high priest. Then later on in Zechariah, we get another vision, chapter 6, verse 9. "The word of the Lord came to me. Take silver and gold from the exiles, Heldai, Tobiah, and Jediah, who have arrived from Babylon. Go the same day to the house of Josiah, son of Zephaniah. Take the silver and gold and make a crown, and set it on the head of the high priest, Joshua, son of Jehozadak. Tell him this is what the Lord Almighty says. Here is a man whose name is the Branch, and he will branch out from this place and build the temple of the Lord. It is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty and will sit and rule on his throne, and he will be a priest on his throne, and there will be harmony between the two. The crown will be given to Heldai, Tobiah, Jediah, and Hen, son of Zephaniah, as a memorial in the temple of the Lord. Those who are far away will come and help build the temple of the Lord, and you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me to you. This will happen if you diligently obey the Lord your God." Another vision. And again, right? The implication, if you're sitting in Jerusalem, is stunning, right? Here is God. He's coming to Joshua, and he's saying, "Look, we're going to put a crown on you, and you're going to go in. We're going to build a temple, and it will get built. And you are going to reconcile not just the religious authority of the temple, but the temporal authority. There's going to be a unification of the temporal rulers and the kings and the religious leaders. We are going to have a religious state here, and it's going to be amazing, and it's going to be glorious. And people from far away, like in Babylon, are going to come help build this temple." And you can imagine sitting there saying, "This is incredible," right? Once again, God is promising. Joshua here is going to become an emblem of going from a completely destroyed place to a glorious and amazing place. And we see these prophecies that way. And if we just step back and imagine, what is the message here? The message is, again, just trust that God's got this under control, and he's going to do glorious things here in Israel. And then we go forward in history, and what ends up happening? Joshua does end up building the temple, and it ends up being built. And then Nehemiah comes in, and they rebuild the wall and the gates, and the city gradually gets cleared. And eventually, Jerusalem rises up from the rubble again, just as God had said, "Trust me, I've got this under control." But there was something very odd about these two prophecies. And the odd thing about the two prophecies is, in both of them, we get this kind of weird phrase in the second one. "Here is the man whose name is the Branch, and he will branch out from its place and build the temple of the Lord." And this idea of the branch, right, that was also in the first prophecy, right? In the first one, back in chapter 3. "I am going to bring my servant the Branch." This idea of the Branch shows up twice. And so maybe, what is the Branch here? And fortunately, the second one tells us, Joshua, "See, I've got my servant, the Branch." And what do? They spread out. So this is also great. Because not only is this a prophecy saying there's this localized place, we're going to build this temple here, but "see my servant, the Branch, which will spread out." And suddenly you're imagining you're in this destroyed city, and you're imagining if we just rebuild the temple, at least that would be something. But then the promise is even bigger. It's not just building this localized thing, it's going to branch out. His servant, the Branch, will spread this out. And you can imagine, maybe it'll spread to all of Israel. This is going to be great. And that's a great message. And again, it would be deeply inspiring to the people that are hearing it, except they also might remember something. This is a fulfillment of prophecy. Now, we don't often think of the prophets fulfilling prophecy, right? We think of the prophets because, let's be honest, we lump them all together. It's that section of the Bible that's a little bit dull, and we sort of just got to skip over it to jump to the New Testament, which gets exciting. And all the prophets just get glommed together. And if you had to do the test, put the prophets in historical order, you're going to win Bible Trivial Pursuit if you can do it, right? And I have no doubt there are people in this room that can do it, but most of us would fail miserably, other than they might be in order in the Old Testament. So maybe if you haven't memorized, you sort of pretend that's the order. But like, which ones are the ones before the Babylonian captivity? I mean, they all blur together in our mind. And so the idea that Zechariah is somehow another a fulfillment of a prophecy and another prophecy is weird, because we don't think of Zechariah and all the other prophets coming in historical sequence. But they do. Zechariah and Haggai are coming much after all the ones before them, right? They're coming after the Babylonian captivity. Some of the prophets were before it. Some were during it. And then there's these few at the end that are after it. Zechariah, in talking about the branch, would immediately cause a memory of an older prophecy, if you knew all the older prophecies, and it's the prophet Isaiah. So let's flip back to Isaiah. And so you can imagine you knew the prophet Isaiah, and you'd sort of heard these stories about Isaiah, or you've heard the prophet Isaiah's readings, or you have some familiarity with it. And imagining you have that familiarity, and then Zechariah comes forth and says, "See my servant the branch," and you'd think, "Branch, I've heard that image before." Zechariah chapter 11. "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of power, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions to the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will lie down with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, the young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw of the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Now that's a familiar passage to lots of Christians, because it's a great passage. And you can imagine, you love this passage, that this sprout will show up and a branch coming from the seed of Jesse. And what will happen? It will bear fruit. And all of these amazing things, peace and prosperity and triumph and glory, will all be there, all starting from this small branch shooting up from the ground. And then Zephaniah comes along and says, "Joshua here, see my servant Joshua, see my servant the branch." And you think, wow, it's here. God promised us a long time ago, this branch will come and it will bring all of this glory. And now we have a high priest here and we look like we're living in rubble, but God has said, "See my servant the branch." And you think, this is it. We're going to build this temple, and it's going to be glorious, and we're going to rebuild this city, and it's going to be glorious, and God is making the prophecies come true right here with Joshua, son of Jehozadak, or whatever the name is, right? Joshua, this really great guy, this high priest here, and this is going to be glorious. And you want to be encouraged in a desolate city? It's hard to imagine a prophecy that would be more encouraging than this sort of thing. Not only am I promising I'm going to do all this stuff, but you remember those promises I made long ago? I'm going to fulfill those promises I made long ago. Now, that would be amazing enough if that's all there was to the story. And one of the problems with talking in churches is, you all know there must be another part to the story, because you all know this branch thing isn't just Joshua, son of whatever, right? And you all have this. So there's another part to this story. Matthew chapter 2. You all knew it was going to be a New Testament. Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2 is kind of an interesting part in Matthew. So Matthew's gospel is a really interesting little biography, because it is endlessly repeating this theme of, you have all these Old Testament stories, look at what's happening in this guy's Jesus' life. So what happens is Jesus is born, and the entire birth narrative looks like an Old Testament story, right? And then Jesus is born, and then what does he do? He goes into Egypt and then comes out of Egypt. And this again brings like, whoa, I think I've heard this story of people going into Egypt and then coming out of Egypt. By the way, in between the time he goes into Egypt and comes out of Egypt, there's a slaughter of a whole bunch of infants, which also reminds us of a story about coming out of Egypt, right? So we have this entire Old Testament narrative going on in this. And then we see this in Matthew chapter 2, verse 19. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea, in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene." Now, this is a weird little phrase here. "So shall be said by the prophets." And notice it's plural, not singular, right? So we've got multiple prophets saying, "He shall be called the Nazarene." Now, where in all the prophets was it prophesied that the Messiah would be called a Nazarene? Where does that phrase occur in the Old Testament? Here's your real Bible trivia contest. Nowhere. It's nowhere in the Old Testament. Not even prophet singular says he shall be called a Nazarene, let alone prophets plural saying he shall be called a Nazarene. Now Matthew, whose whole book here is full of these endless, "Hey, remember the Old Testament, remember the Old Testament, remember the Old Testament," then suddenly saying, "Remember the prophet said he shall be called a Nazarene." It's like, did Matthew not know the Old Testament and he thought it was there somewhere? Or what's going on? What in the world does Matthew mean by "He shall be called a Nazarene," and not only that, the prophet said it? Well, in order to figure that out, we have to know what was significant about Nazareth. And we know what was significant about Nazareth. John's gospel has this marvelous story of Jesus calling the apostles, right? And he calls them, and Philip goes and tells Nathanael, "Hey, we found this guy. He's the guy. He comes from Nazareth." And Nathanael says, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Nazareth was the city we all knew was like just the absolute worst city imaginable. It's the Denver, Colorado of Israel, right? I mean, it's just sort of as bad as it gets, right? And so we have this city that is just despised, right? And everybody knows it's despised and terrible. Nothing good could possibly come from Nazareth. And on top of all of that, right, Pilate, when he mounts the sign above Jesus' head, what does it say? "Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews." And that's like, Jesus the Nazarene? I mean, really, the King of the Jews from Nazareth? In Acts, when the sort of religious leaders of Israel are just foaming at the mouth, complaining to the emperor, late in the book, right, not the emperor, but the king, saying, "This whole set of Christians are terrible," it says, "This sect of Jews from Nazareth," this Nazarene sect, right? Nazareth is constantly showing up in the Old Testament as like a word of insult. "He shall be called a Nazarene" means he's going to be coming from a place that is just pathetic and despicable and despised. And you know what? That idea is all over in the prophets. This idea that the Messiah is not going to be coming from the king of Judah, right? That it's starting from lowly origins. That it just sort of fulfills this idea that there's nothing. And it's all coming from Nazareth, which is kind of an interesting city, right? Nazareth is like the Hebrew word Nezer, pronounce something like that, N-E-S-E-R, Nezer, which means branch. "He shall be called a Nazarene," right? It doesn't say, it's like saying, as the prophet said, "He shall be called a branch." Now, here's the trivia thing. Where was there any prophecy about a servant of God being called a branch? Now, again, you may never have heard this idea of a servant of God being called a branch, but it's back in the book of, anybody know? Zechariah. And we look at this book of Zechariah, and what do we see? We see God talking about Joshua, which is really in Hebrew more like Yeshua, which is really, if you translate it to Greek, kind of like the word Jesus. Well, not kind of like the word Jesus. It is the word Jesus. And here there's this prophecy about Yeshua the high priest. And the Yeshua the high priest is going to be this branch. And we have this branch that's coming out. And what is this branch going to do? This branch is going to unite the religious and the temporal authority all in one grand, glorious kingdom. And there's going to be a magnificent temple built. And all of these phenomenal things are going to happen. And it reminds us of those prophecies in Isaiah, when a branch shall come up out of the root of Jesse. And here Matthew is saying, here's the branch. That branch you read about in Zechariah, here it really is. That branch you read about in Isaiah, here it really is. And suddenly, this whole story about all these exiles from Babylon going back to Jerusalem, we realize, was not really about exiles going back to Babylon. It's really about a story about us and Jesus coming. We are living in the day of small things. We live in a day where we're not really doing anything magnificent. We're not building great kingdoms and great religious things. We're just not doing any of that stuff, right? We live in a world that is full of rubble. And we go out and we do these small little things to try to do this stuff. And you can imagine the messages. Where you live in the day, don't despise the day of small things. Go out, be glad, work at that small thing. And we think, okay, I can go do that. Don't worry that you're living in rubble and there's tons of oppression. Go out and just keep working. Put another brick in the wall. Just keep going and going and going and doing these things. And we think, yeah, that's really, really great. And I can do that. But then what happens? You leave on a Sunday morning thinking, it's going to be great. I'm going to go do these great things. I see the will of God here. I'm part of this grand stream, and it's going to be amazing, and I'm going to build something amazing. But what happened to that temple they built? It was destroyed. And why was it destroyed? It's because the Romans marched in, shattered the walls, and just came in and destroyed the entire city, Jerusalem. It didn't end up being glorious. And we live our lives and we think, okay, I'm going to go do the small thing and it's going to be great and everything's going to work out. And this is finally the moment God is going to reward all my efforts. And what happens? Suddenly it doesn't work out like that. And I realize I'm still living in an age of rubble. Things aren't working out. Life is awful. And it's just awful and there's terrible things. And then you come to church and you hear, oh God, it'll be great, go build things. And maybe we get pumped up and we go build things again. And then it's all rubble again. And life is just full of one disappointment after another disappointment after another disappointment. And we come to church to remind ourselves, oh, it'll be great. Keep working. God tells us, just keep working. Just keep building the wall. Keep putting the little bit of rubble in there. But it never quite materializes. And we are forever building. And we are forever learning that all of those efforts really are small things. As Eliot put it, right? The only wisdom we can hope to attain is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. And it's true. We're looking out at all of this and we think, I got it figured out. This so makes sense. It's going to be great. And then we find out, you know what? I didn't have it all figured out. It's not great still. There's still rubble. You still need to build something. And it's still really hard. And then Zechariah comes along and he says, you know what? Yeah, that's all true. But you know what? There's a branch growing in that rubble. Somewhere out there, there is a shoot coming up out of the ground that will become a branch. And that branch will eventually bear much fruit. And we will eventually live in a world of peace and glory. And everything will come together. And it may not happen today. And it may not happen next year. It takes time for a branch to grow to bear great fruit. But in the midst of all the rubble, in the midst of all the troubles, in the midst of all the toil, in the midst of all the sort of headaches and heartaches of this world, we can just keep remembering, see my servant the branch, and the branch will grow, and the branch will bear fruit. And the entire message of this whole set of books is just that. Endure what is before you, not because what is before you is going to evaporate to tomorrow. We endure what is before us because we have set our eyes on a promise that eventually things will be glorious. And so what do we do in the meantime? Well, we do something that runs so foreign to our nature. We so want to become masters of our fate and control things, and we so want to make it all work out now that we often lose sight that it's not what I do that matters. Building that small temple didn't really matter in the long run. Building the wall didn't really matter in the long run. What matters in the long run is what the branch will do. The branch will bear the fruit. And so we wait. We endure, we work, and we wait. And what are we waiting for? As the poet notes, this is what we're waiting for. O come, thou day spring, come and cheer our spirits by thy advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night and death's dark shadow put to flight. That's what we say. We say, come, and I've got these gloomy shadows of night. Disperse them. O come, thou wisdom from on high, and order all things far and nigh. To us the path of knowledge show, and cause us in her ways to go. We live without knowledge. We live in darkness. And what do we pray? That wisdom will come on high and show us, look, we will see a path here. We will see where to take the next step. O come, desire of nations, bind all peoples in one heart and mind, but bid envy, strife, and quarrel cease. Fill all the world with heaven's peace. That's what we pray. That's what we have to pray day by day by day, that the branch will bear much fruit and that God will bring heaven's peace. And what do we do in the meantime? Well, it's exactly what Mars said. We go out and we tell the truth this week. Telling the truth this week is a small thing. It really doesn't matter in the grand narrative of everything whether you tell the truth this week, but that's our job. Go out and tell the truth this week. Live the Christian life, follow God, and constantly pray and wait for the advent of God bringing peace to all of us on earth. And if we can have that attitude that it is not about me, that it is not about what I want and what I'm trying to do, but ultimately this is God's show, and ultimately God will bring the fruit, and God will bring the peace, and our job is work. Do the small things day after day after day in faithful obedience to God, trusting that God will bring up that branch, and that branch will spread out and bear much fruit. Let's pray.